Just a minute. Mr. Winter.
Yes, good morning, Your Honors. I am Gus Winter of the Nashville, Tennessee Bar. I represent Lucky Capital Management. The trial court committed error when it dismissed Lucky's legal malpractice claim against Miller and Martin in the course of its ruling on a Rule 12b-6 motion to dismiss. Lucky had acquired the legal malpractice claim against Miller and Martin through an assignment from Miller and Martin's client, Envaleo. The trial court concluded that the legal malpractice claim arose out of a fraud committed against the assignor, Envaleo, and accordingly held that the assignment of the legal malpractice claim therefore was invalid pursuant to Georgia Statute 44-12-24. The trial court was wrong about this. What Lucky set forth in its first amended complaint was a legal malpractice claim against Miller and Martin that sounded in negligence, not fraud. Specifically, Lucky alleged that the Miller and Martin lawyers knew or should have known that Envaleo's managing member, Jeff Ritchie, was stealing money from the company.
Before you go further, let me ask you a question. This case was disposed of on summary judgment.
The last surviving claim was...
Motion to dismiss.
Yes.
This case. The complaint attached all sorts of evidentiary exhibits, and the motion to dismiss attached and reflected on evidentiary exhibits. It looked to me as if either was a judgment on the pleadings or a summary judgment, but nobody has objected to the court's disposition of this case on summary judgment. So, in which event, the defendants, by moving for summary judgment, and you leave it in that posture, admit the truth of everything that's in the complaint.
Yes.
Except for the legal conclusions.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's the case. And I believe under Georgia law, and I understand we're in federal court under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, Georgia law requires an affidavit of an expert witness to be filed with a complaint alleging legal malpractice. So out of an abundance of caution, we included that.
I understand.
All right.
But nevertheless, it's an evidentiary exhibit.
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And the point I was making is the allegation of legal malpractice set forth in the First Amendment complaint, and it's reinforced by the affidavit from the expert witness, Mr. Scott, is that Miller and Martin knew or should have known that Mr. Ritchie was stealing money. It failed to report this information to its client, Envaleo, and it also executed a loan document which had the effect of encouraging Mr. Ritchie to steal further funds from Envaleo that Lucky was investing in the company. Georgia law makes a distinction between the negligence of the attorneys Miller and Martin and the fraud committed by the managing member, Jeff Ritchie. And that distinction makes all the difference in the present case. The controlling Georgia decision on this issue is the case of Villanueva versus First American Title Insurance Company. Very similar facts. In Villanueva, the Georgia Supreme Court dealt with a case where a third party committed a fraud against the defendant attorney's client. The fraud succeeded due to the negligence of the attorney. The lawyer's client then assigned that legal malpractice claim, which was pursued by the assignee.
And the claim was he didn't pay the client.
The claim was, well...
he didn't pay the client.
Well, the Georgia Supreme Court...
He didn't pay the insurance...
Yes, that's
pay
correct.
Pay off the mortgage.
And it,
period. That's well, all then, they said in Villanueva.
Well, I believe, as I understand the... not only the Supreme Court's opinion, but the appellate court's opinion, which was affirmed, that the lawyer had dropped the ball in allowing this fraud to succeed.
Succeed because... non-lawyer person was given the opportunity to handle the funds, and it was not taking care of making sure that it was taking that the law firm didn't make sure that its employee did what he was supposed to do.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That was Mr. Allen, I think it was.
I'm sorry?
Mr. Allen?
Yes. So, Your Honor, what we have is where the Georgia Supreme Court upheld the assignment of the legal malpractice claim because the assigned claim sounded in negligence.
But it wasn't, he didn't make the payment. That's what the court said.
Yes.
Let me tell you why I think what's troublesome about this area of the law and why the Supreme Court would not countenance this claim. When you assign a claim like this one to a third party, the third party effectively puts on a show. You take the law firm and the lawyers, and you take whoever was the victim, and all this conversation takes place, and the party filing the lawsuit doesn't have any evidence at all. So the kind of a case that Villanueva would countenance in a malpractice case, in my judgment, you don't have any problem of reenacting the long history between the law firm and the client and the supposed and the information needed to say that there was malpractice here. All you need is the fact. The lawyer didn't file a lawsuit and let the time run. You don't need to worry at all about put on the testimony of the client. It's just it's kind of a mechanical thing. And that's what it was, as I see it, in Villanueva. It was just a mechanical proposition. He didn't pay.
Yes. And
pay to satisfy the mortgages, and therefore he was guilty of malpractice.
Yes, and the point I'm trying to make, and the link, and this is my point, the connection between the Villanueva case and the present case, is that the Georgia Supreme Court held that the fraud committed by the third party in the Villanueva case did not invalidate the assignment. And that's exactly the point I'm making in this case, where the fraud of the managing member, Ritchie, did not destroy the validity of the legal malpractice claim that the client and Vallejo assigned to Lucky. That's my point. The trial court also committed error when it dismissed the fraudulent concealment, the alternative fraudulent concealment.
That's
claim.
All part of the malpractice. All of it comes out. All of it comes out of the so-called malpractice.
No, Your Honor, that's not correct.
It comes out of the professional relationship between the law firm and Vallejo.
It does, but it's not part of the legal malpractice claim. If it was fraud and a fraudulent concealment, that would be prohibited under the Georgia statute for
fraud. Well, and the policy underpinning the statute and all in this rule is that to have a lawsuit in which the assignee has no role, really. The assignee has to put on the play what transpired between the lawyer and the client, all these conversations.
Yes, that's correct. And that's what Lucky was prepared to do. But there
but
is
one,
a,
of, one possible answer to that conundrum that Judge Choflat points to is that Lucky was a member of the client.
Yes.
That Lucky is not a traditional outside assignee. And at the time of these alleged events and acts, Lucky was a member of Envaleo by virtue of its investment. So it was on the inside, not the outside.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that's a very valid point. And I was just coming to
but
that.
But part of that depends on what Florida law provides for at that time. For a limited liability company.
Well,
that law has all been repealed in Florida.
Georgia, yes, it has, Your Honor. Or it's been amended to prohibit
before that,
the
a member was like a stockholder, so there's no relationship between the lawyer and the stockholder.
Well, in this case, there was, and Judge Jordan was touching upon the relationship because the
I know they drew the agreement.
And more than that, Lucky as a member was entitled to be informed of the fraud committed by Ritchie. It's undisputed, even the defendant agrees that Miller & Martin as a fiduciary had an obligation to inform its client of this breach of fiduciary duty by Ritchie. It made no sense to inform the two parties, Poole, the COO, and Ritchie. They already knew they were participating. The obligation was to inform Lucky as the next highest authority, and that's where Rule 1.13 of the Rules of Professional Conduct come in. I see my time is up.
Mr. Mock.
Your Honor, I want to go first to the question that Judge Toflat asked Mr. Winter about the procedural posture. We had a motion to dismiss filed in the case, which was granted as to three counts of the complaint. And the court left a count in the complaint that went into discovery. That was aiding and abetting breach of fiduciary duty count. That went into discovery for about 8 months. We took depositions from Knoxville to Midland, Texas. And we'll talk about the undisputed facts in just a moment. But I want to go straight to Villanueva.
Well, they have to be undisputed facts.
Yes, sir.
Because we're on motion to dismiss. So.
Yes, sir. On the motion to dismiss part, we're talking about the allegations. And on the summary judgment, we're talking about undisputed material facts.
I understand.
So the court dismissed the legal malpractice claim, which was based on this assignment. This assignment occurred in the state of Texas between Envaleo, a Florida company, and Lucky, a Texas company. And at the time of the assignment, no one was thinking about the state of Georgia. But the reason this case was filed in Georgia is because Tennessee, Texas, and Florida all prohibit the assignment of legal malpractice claims. Georgia does now as well. But at the time that the assignment was actually signed, the statute as it existed at that time did not have a per se violation or a per se prohibition on the assignment of legal malpractice claims. However, what the statute did prohibit was the assignment of causes of actions for injuries arising from fraud to the assigner. And that is
the
language.
Can I stop you there?
Yes, sir.
Whose fraud? M&M's fraud? Or Ritchie's fraud?
The statute does not specify that,
but
Judge.
Your position has been that it was, I read from your red brief, it says, the Lucky's legal malpractice claim has a direct causal connection to fraud because the entire basis of the claim is his fraudulent concealment theory.
Yes, sir.
And then you go on to say also on page 30, as it's plain to see, Lucky specifically alleges that Miller and Martin committed malpractice by means, underlined or emphasized, of its otherwise alleged fraudulent concealment. So it seems to me your position has been that you focus in on M&M's actions, not Ritchie's actions.
Well, it's a little bit broader than that, Your Honor.
Based on what you said in your brief.
Yes, sir. When you look at the case law that construes the phrase arising from in Georgia.
Based on.
Arising from is the language that is used in the statute. That says.
Courts have equated that to based on.
Well, any causal connection or relationship is what the Georgia courts have said, Your Honor. And the allegations in the complaint make it clear that they, on the First Amendment complaint, that that's exactly what they were saying. So what Judge Cohen did is he looked at the allegations in the First Amendment complaint, and the First Amendment complaint is replete with allegations of fraud on behalf of Ritchie as well as my client.
Where in count one is there a single word that talks about fraud?
It talks about fraudulent concealment, Your Honor.
Not in count one.
Look at count one.
Well, Your Honor, if in response to our motion to dismiss, in their brief, this is what Lucky said about their count for legal malpractice. They said, the gravamen of the legal malpractice claim presented in the First Amendment complaint is that the law firm learned that Jeff Ritchie, the managing member of its client, Envaleo, was misappropriating the membership interest purchase monies that Lucky was investing in Envaleo, and that Miller and Martin concealed this information from Envaleo and aided and abetted Ritchie in this endeavor. Well, that's the plaintiff.
But there's no, I'm looking at count one. I don't see a single word about fraud, including the affidavit, Mr. Scott's affidavit.
If you're looking.
It speaks in terms of intentional or unintentional, knew or should have known, negligence, lack of care, et cetera, et cetera. I don't see a single word in count one or a reallocation of a claim in another part of the amended complaint that suggests that M&M did anything fraudulent.
If you look at the two paragraphs of count one, which would be paragraphs 18 and 19, I agree it's not there, Your Honor, but everywhere else in the complaint, it's over there, it's over and over again.
Okay, but where in count one is there anything whatsoever that talks about fraud, or even by realleging and adopting an allegation someplace else?
I agree. In those two paragraphs, there's nothing there. In paragraph 18 and 19, there is nothing there.
Including the affidavit.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Doesn't
Paul.
Rule 9 provide that each claim be alleged separately? And if you're going to adopt facts in another part of the complaint, that you have to reallege them?
Well, I think the rule is that the court needs to look at the substance of the pleadings as opposed to just labels that are placed on them.
That's a different issue.
And then
I'm talking about what facts are alleged in count one. They've either set forth in those two paragraphs or they're adopted by reference to another paragraph. Correct?
Well, again, Your Honor.
Is that correct? That's how it's done, right? Pursuant to Rule 9.
Yes, sir.
I don't see any of that.
Well, in their own brief, when they describe their own legal malpractice claim in response to the motion to dismiss, this is what they said. They said the gravamen of it was my client's concealment of this defalcation by Mr. Ritchie. So the court looks at the substance of these allegations and concluded that this claim was based on fraud. But there's nothing, you know, Your Honor, there's nothing that says that it has to be based on my client's fraud. What the statute says is that it is for injuries arising from fraud to the assigner. The assigner here is in Vallejo. The court looked at what the injuries were and interpreted this statute to mean that this claim was arising from, or that this was for injuries arising from fraud to in Vallejo.
The statement you just said that you attribute to the appellant, Lucky.
Yes, sir.
Is that in reference to the malpractice claim, or is that in reference to the fraudulent concealment claim, which was dismissed?
That was in reference to the malpractice claim. Again, if I could just quote part of this very briefly, the gravamen of the legal malpractice claim presented in the first amended complaint is that the law firm learned that Jeff Ritchie, the managing member of its client Invaleo LLC, was misappropriating the membership interest purchase monies that Lucky was investing in Invaleo, and that Miller and Martin concealed this information from Invaleo and aided and abetted Ritchie in this endeavor. Based on that, Your Honor, that's an admission. That is their own interpretation of what they were saying, and based on that, Judge Cohen made the correct decision.
But that's not what Scott affidavit says, and that's not what the allegations say. They talk about knew or should have known and should have disclosed it, either because they knew about it or they should have known about it, which is classic negligence.
Well, it would still be for injuries arising from fraud to the assigner, Your Honor.
Well, but not M&M's fraud. You're talking about Richie's fraud now.
Well, the statute does not say whose fraud it has to be. It says for injuries arising from fraud to the assigner. The assigner was Invaleo. Clearly, they have alleged that Invaleo, the assigner, has been defrauded.
Let me attack it from a different perspective, Mr. Mock, if I could. It may be the case that Lucky thought that M&M had committed actionable fraud. But it may also be that Lucky, at the end of the day, might not have had enough evidence to prove to a jury or to a judge that M&M engaged in actionable fraud. That doesn't mean that Lucky didn't have enough evidence or didn't plead enough facts to allege that M&M committed negligence. And the federal rules allow you to plead in the alternative. Maybe not prove in the alternative, but at the very beginning, you can plead in the alternative. You can plead fraud, actionable fraud with intent, or alternatively, negligence. And it seems to me that that's exactly what this complaint is. It alleges actionable fraud in the tort counts, right? The fraudulent concealment, the aiding and abetting, and all that. And as Judge Huck indicated, it alleges pure run-of-the-mill attorney negligence on count one. Given that you can plead in the alternative, how in the world does count one not survive?
Well, you have to go back again to the language of OCGA 44-1224 that says if the injury arises from fraud to the assigner. Again, the assigner here is
in the layup. But it doesn't, the claim against M&M for malpractice does not depend on M&M's fraud. So you're saying that any time that a malpractice claim is based on fraud pre-2013, you could not assign it?
Yes, sir.
And give me one case in Georgia that says that.
Well, in fact, there is no case that specifically says that.
And if that's the case.
Nor does Villanueva say that.
I'll take that on its face that you are right about both of those points. If that's the case, how can a district judge dismiss as a matter of law a claim on which there is no dispositive interpretation of Georgia law?
Because the statute says that if the action is for injuries arising from
fraud,
I
know what the statute says because you've told us a couple of times.
Yes, sir.
But you're telling me that there is no legal interpretation in Georgia as to what arising out of fraud means and to whom it refers. If there is no exposition of that phrase in Georgia law, how can you say as a matter of law that count one is barred by Georgia law?
There are cases that interpret the phrase arising from, and we've cited those in our brief, and it says that almost any causal connection or relationship satisfies the phrase arising from.
That's in the insurance context, correct?
Well, there is an insurance coverage case. There's another case where they've also used that. But yes, okay. Arising from.
But both the Villanueva courts have equated arising from to mean based on, because that's how they describe it.
Well, there's any causal connection or relationship.
No, they use the words, the Villanueva court used the words based on. Instead of saying arising from, they substituted that with based on.
Well, based on would mean.
Isn't that what Villanueva courts did?
Beg your pardon, Your Honor?
Isn't that what the Villanueva courts, both of them, did? They used the phrase based on, a claim based on fraud on the SNL.
Well, what the Villanueva court did not do is it did not construe.
I want to know what they did do. They used the term based on.
They did not interpret this part of the statute. There was no allegation in Villanueva that the claim arose from the fraud of the assigner. The question in Villanueva was whether or not.
Okay, let me read for you what they said.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And I'm just picking out one head notes, page 167. And here, the alleged legal malpractice is not based on fraud.
Yes, sir.
So they equated rising from with based on.
Well,
and both courts did that.
That's the language of the decision. The point I'm trying to make in Villanueva is the issue was whether there was a per se prohibition on the assignment of legal malpractice claims in Georgia.
But wasn't there fraud in Villanueva that led to everything?
There was theft.
Whatever you call, how can that not be fraud? How can a person who is not a lawyer take money from an escrow account and close the account and not engage in fraud?
Well, those are the facts, Your Honor, but what I'm trying to say is there was no issue.
Tell me how that cannot be actionable fraud.
Yes, sir, I'm trying to do that, Your Honor. The issue in Villanueva, there was no argument that that had arose from fraud to the assigner. The issue was whether there was a public policy in the state of Georgia against the assignment of legal malpractice claims and whether there was a per se prohibition against that. The Supreme Court said.
Court said no. And
said
all this
no,
was a suit to collect the money due.
Yes, they said there's no per se
violation. He was negligent and not paying the money.
There was no argument in Villanueva that it had arisen from fraud and therefore.
Villanueva's holding is very narrow because
yes,
all it had before the court was the failure to pay.
That's exactly right.
And they had an obligation to pay.
That is correct.
As a lawyer.
That is correct.
So it was malpractice. That set of facts.
No one argued that had arisen from fraud.
So the court didn't decide anything else. Anything else the court said was dicta,
That's correct. This case, you
say the fraud could be either the law firm's fraud, M&M's fraud, or Richie's fraud.
If the injury arose from
position.
Fraud to the assigner.
That's your position.
Yes, sir.
It's either or.
Yes, sir.
And you, there's nothing at least in the count one, that suggests that what Ritchie did was fraudulent. It was defalcation, misappropriation. In other words, he stole the money. That's not fraud, unlike Mr. Allen in the Villanueva case. Ritchie is accused of taking money he shouldn't have taken. That's not fraud, is it?
Well, they allege fraudulent concealment by Ritchie.
No. But in that case, isn't that what he did? Isn't that what they say in the count one, the malpractice account, that Ritchie misappropriated, defalcated, took money that he shouldn't have taken?
In the First Amendment complaint, yes, Your Honor.
And that's not fraud, is it?
I believe that is fraud.
Well, fraud is a misrepresentation or omission of a material fact, censor, and the intent for the person to rely on the misrepresentation, justifiable reliance, and damages. I don't see that anywhere. When someone in charge of, you know, the CEO of this, or the head guy and the limited liability company took money that he shouldn't have taken, there's nothing to suggest he did it by a fraudulent means. He just did it. He just took the money.
What the judge is saying is you got to have a representation and reliance on the representation.
Well, you can also have fraud by fraudulent concealment. A misrepresentation is not
always... You have to have a misrepresentation and a reliance that is not unreasonable.
Yes, sir. But you can have fraudulent concealment.
Yeah, I understand that. But who... If Ritchie committed a fraud, who was the victim? To whom did he make a representation, and who relied on it?
I'm not sure that we have that type of fraud in this alleged case.
All right, so it's nothing more than theft.
Well, we would say fraudulent concealment, but my time's up.
Can I ask you one quick?
Yes,
sir. Can I just ask one question about
sure.
The last count, the conspiracy count? The judge dismissed that as well,
yes,
because
sir.
He dismissed the fraudulent concealment case because there was no duty. But since, yeah, and he was correct. You have to have an underlying tort to have conspiracy. But isn't the underlying tort the wrongdoing by Ritchie? And there is obviously a duty of Ritchie to end Vallejo, not to steal the money or not to defraud them.
Well, you're correct. You have to have an underlying tort. The court found that there was no underlying tort and dismissed the conspiracy claim.
All conspiracy is a way to hold somebody for somebody else's tort.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
But he said there was no tort by, there was no fraudulent concealment tort by the law firm, right?
Yes, sir.
But he didn't talk about the tort committed by Ritchie, which allegedly the law firm participated in and was a co-conspirator.
Well, on the fraudulent concealment claim, there first must be a duty, and there was no duty owed by my client to Lucky, who was not my client's client. And
there was no duty from the law firm to
Lucky
and Vallejo.
No, to Lucky.
To Lucky.
Yes,
right. Okay. But that's not the underlying basis for the conspiracy claim. The underlying basis is Ritchie's wrongful act, whether it was theft, misappropriation, or fraud, was the basis. And the allegation is that the law firm participated in Lucky's fraudulent activity or theft activity.
The allegations were by not informing Lucky that Mr. Ritchie had taken this money, but the court said there was no duty owed by my client to do that in the first place.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Now we can have a disagreement. Thank you.
Mr. Winter.
Yes, just one point.
Mr. Winter, some of this problem, I think, is because the nature of your pleadings or whoever did the pleadings in the, it's not a shotgun pleading. It's just the opposite of a shotgun pleading. You've got all these allegations in the front part of the complaint. Then you go to count one. There's not a single realleging of anything that preceded it or anything that comes after count one. And I think that is probably some of the reason why there was this confusion as to what exactly was being pled, particularly with regard to fraud, because there are allegations of fraud out there. But in my view, they're not in count one. I agree with you on that. But I see where some of this problem came about.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and the buck stops here in terms of the drafting of the pleadings. And if they were confusing to the trial court, that's certainly on me. But I believe this court certainly understands that in a response to a Rule 12b-6 motion, the pleading party is entitled to every inference and favorable construction of the allegations presented in the complaint. And as Your Honor stated, count one, paragraphs 18 and 19, set forth a pretty garden variety negligence claim. The one point I would like to make, and to follow up on Your Honor's last questions to Mr. Mock about conspiracy, Your Honor is right that there is an allegation on the conspiracy that the substantive acts, setting aside completely for the moment, for the sake of argument, the fraudulent concealment claim against Miller and Martin, but Ritchie's conspiracy, his acts, and the participation by Miller and Martin, which defense counsel did not address, is the drafting of the loan document, which gave camouflage and cover and served to conceal and protect this ongoing...
Well, for a conspiracy, the law firm has to understand what Ritchie's about. Ritchie's the one committing the tort.
Yes, Your Honor, and we submit that there are facts...
Vicarious liability theory.
Yes, I mean,
hook somebody in because they went along with it.
Yes, and we submit that there are, in the material submitted in response to the summary judgment motion...
What you should have done when you saw the summary judgment motion, or the response... Actually, it was the response... It was the motion to dismiss in the memorandum. You should have moved for leave to amend your complaint. It would have cured the problem that Judge Huck just mentioned.
Perhaps so, Your Honor.
It's almost impossible for a district judge to decide a motion to dismiss by looking at at the complaint, the motion to dismiss, and a response. Then what is the pleading?
I understand, but at any rate, I submit that we have raised genuine disputes of material fact as to Miller and Martin's knowledge of these defalcations by Mr. Ritchie. Thank you.
Move to the third case.